She wasn't a therapist. She didn't have a license. No office hours, no paperwork, just candles, lies, and a velvet chair where broken women sat and left reborn, as monsters. They came to her for healing. She gave them revenge. Cheating husbands exposed. Marriages destroyed. Children abandoned. And somewhere in the chaos, a body count began to rise, until the ghosts of her past came knocking, and the empire she built on pain started to burn. This is not your fucking therapist. And no one walks away clean. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you, Not Your Fucking Therapist. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Chair. It starts with the fucking chair. Not the beige knockoff from Wayfair that I placed in the corner, so it looks like I give a damn about my client's comfort. No, that's just set dressing. I'm talking about my chair. The one that matters. It's a tall, black, throne-like seat draped in velvet. The kind of thing you'd imagine a villainess reclining in while sipping blood-red wine. Except I don't drink wine. I drink power. And every time my ass hits that chair, I become the version of myself this world was too afraid to nurture. Dr. Vanessa Ellis, PhD, trauma counselor, women's empowerment specialist, certified life coach, 15.7K followers on Instagram, 5-star Google reviews, a Twitter bio that reads, "Helping women unlearn the lies they were taught to survive." Sounds noble, right? Bullshit. You want to know the truth? My name's not Vanessa. Never was. It's Talia fucking Monroe, born in a dusty 2-bedroom apartment in Trenton, New Jersey, raised on black coffee and dysfunction. No degree. No license. No credentials. Just instinct, a razor-sharp tongue, and the ability to read broken women like open books. And trust me, most of them are begging to be rewritten. I built this empire on pain. Not mine, theirs. I harvest it like a damn crop. Hurt women are the most fertile ground for manipulation. They're raw, exposed, desperate for meaning. And when the world fails them, as it always does, they come to me. The loft I run this little operation from? It's all aesthetic. Tall industrial windows, exposed brick, overpriced candles that smell like trauma, lavender, bergamot, guilt. A faux bookshelf filled with titles no one will ever touch. Tissues placed just close enough for them to feel safe, but far enough for them to struggle. It's all part of the performance. They walk in scared, shaky hands, puffy eyes, mascara smudged like war paint. And me, I stay calm, serene, saintly, hair slicked back into a bun, so tight it gives the illusion of control. Neutral tones, minimal jewelry, a notepad I never actually write in. Just scribbles, enough to make them think I'm paying attention. But I am paying attention, just not to what they think. I'm watching how they fold their arms, how long it takes them to make eye contact, the way their voice changes when they talk about their mothers. I'm looking for entry points, cracks in the facade, little weaknesses I can poke until they bleed. And when they do, that's when I get to work. Her name was Alina, 32, marketing exec, beautiful in that polished, uptight way. The kind of woman who irons her pillowcases and uses the word artisanal without irony. She walked in on a Tuesday afternoon looking like she was 5 minutes from falling apart, which meant I had just enough time to break her all the way. She sat down slow, like the seat might reject her, eyes darting around the room, trying to read the place, trying to make sense of what she was about to confess. "He cheated on me," she said, barely louder than a whisper. I didn't flinch, didn't gasp, didn't offer a tissue, just locked eyes with her, nodded slowly and said, "Of course he did." Her head jerked back. She was expecting sympathy. Tears. Maybe a gentle, rehearsed, "I'm so sorry that happened to you." "Nah, that's not what I sell." "I'm sorry," she said, confused. "What do you mean? Of course he did." I leaned back, crossed one leg over the other, laced my fingers together like some fucking oracle, and smiled. "Alina, look at you. You're smart. Successful. You run circles around the average man intellectually. You intimidate him emotionally. Of course he cheated. Weak men do weak things when they don't know how to rise to your level." Her jaw dropped. I could practically see the gears turning. The narrative shift. The justification she didn't know she needed until I handed it to her like a warm blanket. "Cheating wasn't about you," I added, softer now. "It was about his need to feel powerful. You threatened that. And instead of leveling up, he sunk down. That's not your burden." Her voice cracked. "But I gave him everything. I sacrificed so much. I cut her off, gently, but with enough force to sting. Stop. Don't ever say that shit again. She blinked. Hard. You didn't give. You lost. And you lost to someone who doesn't even deserve to speak your name. That's when it happened, the click. The tiny spark behind her eyes. That shift from victim to vengeful goddess. It always starts small. A tightening of the jaw. A flare of the nostrils. And then it spreads like wildfire. You want to know what I'd do? I asked, voice dropping into that conspiratorial whisper that makes women feel like they're in on something sacred. She nodded, already leaning forward, already hooked. I'd fuck his best friend, I said, pausing for the sting. And I'd make sure he finds out in the worst possible way. Leave a pair of your panties under the seat of his car. Send yourself flowers from his phone. Give him a taste of his own poison. Alina didn't laugh this time. She smiled. Slowly. Like someone discovering a new shade of themselves in the mirror. I couldn't, she started. But you could, I interrupted. And you should. Because men like him don't learn through kindness. They learn through consequence. And just like that, she was mine. That's the real therapy I offer. Not healing. Not growth. Not closure. I offer revenge. I offer rebirth through rage. I hold up the mirror and show them their most violent selves, then tell them it's beautiful. And they eat it the fuck up. I've got women torching their exes' cars, draining joint bank accounts, posting videos online to ruin reputations. They call it liberation. Empowerment. Fuck, they even thank me. And the best part? The chaos feeds me. Every time a husband cries, a mistress gets exposed, a wedding gets called off, I sleep a little deeper. There's a dark satisfaction in knowing I can destroy lives with nothing but words and a calm voice. People ask me sometimes, the few who know the truth, how I sleep at night, like a baby. Because here's the thing they don't get. The world is already on fire. I just pass out gasoline. But it's not all fun and games. Sometimes I slip. Sometimes I push too hard. Sometimes women snap in ways I didn't see coming. But I'll save that for later. For now, all you need to know is this. I'm not your fucking therapist. I never was. I'm the voice in your head when your moral compass breaks. I'm the friend who tells you to slash his tires and smile while doing it. I'm the bad idea you follow through on because fuck it, why not? And if you're sitting in front of me broken, bleeding, betrayed, baby, you're already mine. Chapter 2, The Lie We Choose. You know what's funny? The second time a woman walks into my space, she walks different. The first time, they drag their shame through the door like a corpse. Eyes down, voice small, broken posture. But the second time, that's when I know I've got them. That's when they walk in like they're wearing a secret. Like they've seen some new truth they can't unsee. Alina was no different. She came back 3 days after our first session. Not the usual 7 I recommend. 3. That told me everything I needed to know. She walked in wearing red lipstick. The kind of red that screams, fuck you, to anyone who looks at it too long. Her blazer was tighter. Her heels were taller. Her energy? Wild. Untethered. Dangerous in that delicious. Freshly reborn and doesn't know her power yet kind of way. She dropped her purse on the couch like it offended her. Didn't even wait for me to offer the seat. Just sat down, legs crossed, eyes locked on mine. I did it, she said. I smiled slow, like a proud parent watching their kid ride a bike for the first time. If the bike were on fire and the kid was steering it toward a cliff. Did what, babe? I asked, knowing full well what she meant. I fucked his best friend, she said, voice steady. Last night. At his condo. I nodded, calm as ever. How do you feel? She hesitated. And that's when I saw it. The little sliver of guilt still clinging to her ribs. It was tiny, but it was there. Festering. Threatening to rot the whole high she was riding on. I feel, she exhaled, eyes darting to the floor. I feel powerful. But also, kind of disgusting. There it is. The poison of morality. That creeping sickness that tells women they should feel bad about reclaiming control. I've seen it 1,000 times. Society injects it into them at birth. Be good. Be quiet. Be forgiving. Fuck all that. You don't feel disgusting, I said, voice firm. You feel conditioned. You've been brainwashed into thinking vengeance is a sin. It's not. It's justice with better marketing. She looked up, caught in the gravity of my conviction. I leaned forward, elbows on my knees, tone lower now. Do you think he felt disgusting while he was cheating on you? No, she whispered. Do you think his friend felt disgusting while fucking you? No. So why the fuck should you feel anything other than victorious? Alina blinked. Hard. And just like that, the guilt started to erode. She was mine again. You see, I don't just advise these women. I reprogram them. I strip away their borrowed values, their inherited shame, and I replace it with something raw and primal, something that belongs to them. Most people live their lives chasing approval from partners, parents, pastors, therapists, Instagram followers. Me, I teach them how to stop chasing, how to burn it all down and build something darker, stronger. And I don't just do it for them. I do it for me. Because watching women unravel is the closest thing I've ever had to religion. Their breakdowns are holy. Their rage is sacred. Every time one of them sheds her good girl skin, I feel like I've done something divine. You want to know how I got like this? You think maybe some guy hurt me? Daddy issues? Toxic relationship? Childhood trauma? No, it wasn't any of that. It was a job. 7 years ago, I was an assistant at a mental health clinic in Newark. Minimum wage, under fluorescent lights, filing insurance paperwork for doctors who couldn't remember my name, watching real therapists, the licensed kind, sit behind glass and hand out platitudes like Halloween candy. Have you tried journaling? You need to forgive yourself. Deep breaths. Meanwhile, the women coming in were bleeding emotionally. Their husbands were beating them. Their kids were suicidal. Their minds were collapsing under the weight of pretending everything was fine. And all these so-called professionals could do was slap a fucking diagnosis on them and send them home with a prescription. That's when it hit me. These women didn't need treatment. They needed permission. Permission to scream. To rage. To retaliate. To not forgive. They didn't need healing. They needed someone to say, "Yes, you can burn that motherfucker's life to the ground and still be worthy of peace." And no one was saying it. So I did. I started small. I'd whisper things in waiting rooms. Slipped numbers into palms. Met in cafes and bars and laundry rooms. I built trust like a slow drip. And then I gave them fire. It grew. Word spread. My name changed. My location shifted. I made myself harder to track. I gave myself a brand. A story. A PhD I never earned, but no one ever questioned. Because when a woman walks into a room and speaks with conviction, people believe her. Especially if she's got good lighting and a shelf full of fake credentials. You think that's evil? Maybe it is, but it's effective. Back to Alina. After her confession, I didn't schedule our next session. I told her to wait, told her to sit in the silence, let the consequences come to her. That was part of the game. You have to let them feel the weight of their actions, let it settle into their bones. Otherwise, it's just performance. And I don't traffic in performance. I want transformation. That night, she texted me. "Alina," he found out. He showed up at my apartment screaming. "Me good. That means it worked. Alina," he called me a slut. Said I ruined his life. "Me." He ruined his life the second he chose to betray you. You just handed him the invoice. She didn't reply after that. I knew she needed time. The next morning, she sent a photo. Her smiling, middle finger up, standing in front of a box of his things on fire in the driveway. I laughed out loud. That's the moment. The rebirth. The final breath of the old self before the ashes scatter. Alina wasn't Alina anymore. She was mine now. And soon she'd send others. Because that's how this works. Word of mouth. Trauma to trauma. Rage begets rage. Later that night, I sat in my chair and stared at the candle flickering beside me. The room was empty, quiet, except for the low hum of the city outside the window. I should have felt proud. Maybe I did. But something in me stirred. A feeling I didn't recognize. Not guilt. Not fear. Just awareness. Of how far this had gone. Of what I was becoming. Of how deep the lie had grown. But then my phone lit up. New client inquiry. Subject, urgent. Marriage falling apart. Need help immediately. And just like that, the doubt faded. Because there's always another woman. Another wound. Another war. And I'm still here, velvet chair, black heart, open arms. Not your fucking therapist. Just the voice you hire when your life stops making sense and you're ready to burn it all to hell. Chapter 3. Rotten fruit tastes sweetest. There's a scent I've come to recognize. It's not the perfume, not the lotion, not the coffee breath or the faint trail of office hallway anxiety. It's the scent of desperation. It lingers in the air before they speak. It sits on their skin, thick like molasses. And when they open their mouths, it pours out like rot from fruit left in the sun too long. You can't Febreze that shit. You can't hide it under therapy talk and forced optimism. I smell it the second she walks in. Tall. Black heels. Designer trench coat. The kind of woman who usually has people like me on speed dial to organize her life, not dissect it. She walks like power. Chin up. Shoulders back. But her eyes? Her eyes betray her. They scan the room too fast, like she's memorizing exits. Like she's calculating danger, or worse, opportunity. She introduces herself with the name Carmen. No last name. No small talk. Just Carmen. I don't ask for more. That's part of the spell. No intake forms. No paperwork. No HIPAA. Just shadows and whispers and cash in an envelope if she's smart. She takes the seat across from me like she owns the space. I like that. Confidence. Ego. But I also know it's a shell. And I know exactly where to crack it. So Carmen, I say slowly, letting her hear the weight in my voice. What brings you in? She doesn't answer right away. Instead, she crosses her legs slowly, deliberately. Her heels tap against the hardwood. And then she says something I didn't expect. I want to destroy a man. Not I need help. Not I'm in pain. Not I don't know what to do. Straight to the blood. My kind of woman. I tilt my head, studying her. Tell me about him. She exhales. Not shaky, not fragile, just tired. Worn out from rage that's been simmering for too long. His name's Lance. Married. CFO of some bullshit startup. We were together for 3 years. He promised me the moon, told me he'd leave his wife, move out, build us a life. The whole fantasy. And now he's ghosted me. Like I was just a fucking hobby he outgrew. I let the silence stretch. It makes them nervous. Makes them fill in the blanks. Carmen doesn't bite, though. She just stares at me, like she's waiting for permission to fall apart. But I don't give her that. I give her what she came for. You still have access to him? I ask, voice low. She smirks, but there's no joy in it. I still have access to his secrets. Bingo. The thing about women like Carmen is that they don't want to heal. Healing would mean letting go. They want revenge. They want blood. And they want someone to tell them that it's okay. That destruction is just another form of self-care. I lean forward slightly. Tell me everything you know about him. She does. For the next 40 minutes, she lays it all out. Passwords. Photos. Emails. Screenshots. Voice notes. She's done her homework. And not just scorned lover homework. Intelligence level shit. She knows where he banks. Where he hides money. Where his wife shops. Where his kids go to school. She's not here to cry. She's here to burn. And honestly, I'm impressed. I want him ruined, she says when she's done. I want his wife to know. His job to know. I want every woman he ever meets after me to flinch when they hear his name. I nod, like a priest hearing a particularly juicy confession. I can help you do that. Her eyes flash. How? And now we're in my favorite part. The performance. I stand up slowly, walk over to the bookshelf and pull down a black leather-bound journal. Purely for show, of course. Inside are pages filled with chicken scratch, symbols, doodles. Nothing real. But people believe what looks official. I flip a few pages and say, First, you need to understand this isn't about him anymore. She frowns. What? This is about you. About taking the version of yourself that allowed him to treat you like an afterthought, and turning her into someone he'll regret losing for the rest of his miserable fucking life. Her breathing shifts. I can see it, the beginning of the transformation. That flicker of something primal and raw and alive under her skin. But if you want to do this, I continue, voice low and sharp, there's no half-assing it. No pulling back at the last minute. No apologies. No guilt. Once you cross this line, Carmen, you don't get to go back to who you were before. I don't want to go back, she says, her voice barely more than a whisper. I smile. Good. I send her home with homework. Fake emails to set up. Burner accounts to create. Triggers to plant. Photos to send anonymously to his wife. But not all at once. No, we drip feed the poison. Let it unfold like a slow, elegant horror show. The kind you can't look away from. She's excited. I can see it in the way she walks out. Posture tighter, chin higher. Not healed. Not yet. But evolving. Shifting into the next version of herself. The villain in someone else's story. My favorite kind. After she leaves, I sit in the silence. It's nearly midnight. The city outside is humming, but in here, everything is still. There's something about the aftermath of a session like that, like the energy sticks to the walls. I breathe it in, let it curl inside me. I pull out my phone and open a file I keep hidden, a long encrypted note titled The Archive. It's not really for clients. It's for me. Each entry is a story. Names, dates, outcomes. A record of the women I've helped dismantle their own lives and others. Client number 043, Alina. Burned ex's clothes. Severed contact. Moved cities. Now engaged to the ex-best friend. Client number 018, Ava. false harassment claim against CEO X settled privately. Now owns a nail salon. Client number 051 Carmen. In progress. Sometimes I wonder why I keep them. Maybe it's ego. Maybe I just like knowing I've had my fingers in so many people's lives without ever getting caught. Or maybe it's a reminder that I've created something real in a world that only respects results. Because I may not be a therapist, but I am a creator. I mold chaos. I sculpt vengeance. I design emotional collapses with the precision of a fucking architect. And they call it therapy. One last thing before I go to sleep. I light a match and let it burn down to my fingertips before tossing it into a glass bowl. The fire flares for a moment, enough to remind me of something important. Empathy is a leash, and I chewed mine off a long time ago. Chapter 4, Ghosts Don't Knock. I don't believe in ghosts. Not the dead ones, anyway. The real ghosts are living people. The ones who know too much about you, who walk into rooms uninvited, who drag the past into your present like it's a prize instead of a wound. The ones you didn't bury deep enough. And today, one of mine came knocking. It was just past 11 a.m. I hadn't even lit the candles yet. My coffee was still warm, and I was scrolling through Carmen's updates, burner screenshots, email drafts, a video she was planning to leak of Lance slipping into a hotel with some 20-something intern. The chaos was unfolding beautifully. I was sipping the last of my espresso when the buzzer rang. No appointment. No warning. Just the sudden buzz that always makes my nerves twitch. I thought about ignoring it, but something told me not to. I walked to the monitor, pressed the intercom. Yes. Static. Then a voice I hadn't heard in years. Don't hang up. It's me. Silence stretched, thick and heavy. It was Eli. And just like that, my stomach twisted. Eli fucking Castillo. We used to work together back at the clinic in Newark. Before all of this. Before the name change. Before I became Dr. Vanessa Ellis, trauma whisperer and chaos dealer. Back when I was still just Talia Monroe, receptionist, printer jam fixer, and low-key scammer. Eli was a counselor. One of the good ones, too good, honestly. Kind intuitive, idealistic as fuck. He believed people could change. Believed in the system. Believed in me. And I used that. He had this thing for me, unspoken but obvious. I could see it in the way he lingered by my desk, the way he defended me when I accidentally deleted files or made up patient messages. I'd flash him a smile, maybe touch his arm when I handed him coffee, and he'd light up like Christmas. He never said anything, never tried anything, but he watched. He saw more than I wanted him to, and apparently he still remembers. I buzzed him in. Don't ask me why. Curiosity? Arrogance? Some sick thrill that comes from dancing with danger? He walked in like a fucking memory, same scruffy beard, same intense brown eyes, same overwashed hoodie and worn jeans. He hadn't changed much, but I had. Wow, he said, looking around the loft. This is not what I expected. I stayed standing, arms crossed. What the fuck do you want, Eli? He smiled faintly, but it didn't reach his eyes. Nice to see you too, Talia. That name hit harder than I expected, like a slap with a cold hand. It's been years since anyone's used it in this space. I gestured toward the client chair, the beige one, like this was a regular session. You came all the way here. Sit. Say what you came to say. He didn't sit. Instead, he stepped closer, looking around like he was trying to figure out what kind of monster I'd become. Vanessa Ellis, huh? He said softly. Jesus. You even sound like a therapist now. I am one, I snapped. At least to the people who matter. He laughed. Not cruel. Just tired. You really believe that? I didn't answer. He walked over to the bookshelf and ran his fingers across the fake degrees I had printed and framed years ago. For a second, I saw the flicker of something, sadness maybe. Regret. Nostalgia. You were smart back then. Creative. I always thought you'd end up doing something big. I am doing something big. He turned to face me. You're manipulating broken women into doing stupid shit for your own entertainment. Don't be so dramatic. He stepped forward. You're hurting people, Talia. No, I said, voice calm but cold. I'm showing them who they really are. And who are you, huh? He shot back. Some trauma witch with a god complex? I smiled. Closer than you think. He stared at me. Long hard. Like he was trying to see past the makeup, the clothes, the posture. Trying to find the girl he used to know. She's gone, I said quietly. I can see that, he replied. I could have ended it there. Told him to leave. Threatened him. But I didn't. Because there was something else in his voice, something heavier. Why are you really here, Eli? He took a deep breath, rubbed his jaw, then finally sat down in the client chair. Looked so out of place in it, I almost laughed. "I have a client. She mentioned your name." That stopped me. He continued, "She said she found you through a friend, that you helped her, gave her clarity, told her to take back her power." I said nothing, just let the words hang. "She also said her ex tried to kill himself after she leaked personal information about him." I leaned back in my chair, kept my face blank. "So what? That's on him." Eli's eyes burned. "Is it? Don't come in here playing moral cop, Eli. You work in mental health. You know people make their own choices. And you know how vulnerable they are," he snapped. "You know they're looking for someone to guide them, not push them off a fucking cliff." "I'm not pushing. I'm opening the door. They walk through it on their own. You're playing with fire, Talia. And someone's going to get burned." "Good," I whispered. "Maybe that's what they fucking need." He stood abruptly. The tension in the room was thick enough to slice with a knife. "You need to stop," he said, "before someone gets hurt. Or worse." I rose too, slow and deliberate, matching his energy. "You don't get to tell me what to do. You never did." He shook his head. "I'm not here to control you. I'm here to warn you." "Why? Out of love? Loyalty? Nostalgia?" "No," he said, eyes narrowing. "Because I still believe there's a part of you that doesn't want to become a monster." I laughed. Laughed so hard it cracked something in my chest. "Oh, baby," I said, walking past him to open the door. "That part of me died a long time ago." He stared at me a moment longer. Then left. Didn't say goodbye. Didn't look back. After he was gone, I sat in the dark. No candles. No music. Just me and the silence. My hands were shaking, and I hated that. I poured a glass of whiskey. Drank it straight. Let it burn. Why did he come now? Why did he care? And why the fuck did it still bother me? I looked around the loft. The throne. The candles. The fake books. The facade I'd built. Was it really that fragile? No. Fuck that. I'm not the villain. I'm the answer. And if ghosts want to rise from the past, I'll burn them with the present. Chapter 5, Smoke in the Mirror. It started with a headline. I was in the middle of a session with a client named Janelle, a 26-year-old stylist whose ex was trying to take custody of their son. She was telling me about his new girlfriend, some Pilates instructor with too many teeth and too little brain. I was mid-sentence. "What you need to do is make him think she's a threat to your child's safety, not you." When my phone lit up on the side table. A notification banner. Breaking. CFO of Sterling Tech resigns amid scandal involving leaked sex tapes and alleged infidelity. I knew immediately. Carmen. Janelle kept talking, oblivious to the slow, molten realization crawling down my spine. I nodded, murmured something about boundaries and court-approved parenting strategies, but my mind was nowhere in that room. As soon as she left, eyes glowing with vengeance and false empowerment, just how I like them, I pulled up the article. Sterling Tech CFO Lance Mercer has resigned effective immediately following an explosive leak of footage showing the executive entering a local hotel with a woman identified as neither his wife nor company employee. The footage, accompanied by an anonymous series of emails sent to news outlets and Mercer's own HR department, contained further damaging claims, including screenshots, bank transfers, and a spreadsheet of ongoing affairs dating back 3 years. It got worse the further I read. Quotes from anonymous sources. Company stock dipped 11%. Wife had filed for divorce. One unnamed board member quoted as saying, "It's a public relations disaster. Everything's imploding. Everything was imploding. And I caused it." Well, Carmen did. But I unleashed her. I crafted her chaos. She was the sword. I was the hand that sharpened it. I checked my burner app. 3 messages from Carmen. "Carmen, it's done. Carmen, he's ruined. Carmen, tell me, do I get to feel peace now?" I stared at the screen for a long time. I didn't answer. Because I didn't know what the fuck to say. The thing about puppets is that they don't always dance the way you think they will. Sometimes they cut their strings and start slicing throats with them. Carmen had followed the plan, sure, but she'd gone off script too. That footage? That spreadsheet? I never told her to do all that. And those emails? There were phrases I'd never say. Too emotional. Too revealing. Too traceable. She got cocky. Sloppy. And now it was on every news outlet in the damn city. I closed my laptop and walked across the loft. Everything felt off. Tilted. Like the floor had shifted 3 degrees and I hadn't caught up yet. I lit 3 candles out of habit. Sage. Clove. Vetiver. Tried to ground myself in ritual. But it didn't work. My pulse wouldn't settle. because for the first time it felt real. Not just a woman burning her ex's shit in the driveway. Not just a mistress exposing receipts in a group chat. This was corporate collapse. A man's entire public identity gone. And somewhere in the center of the firestorm was my fucking name. I didn't think she'd do it, but she had. In the final leaked message to his wife, cleverly labeled truth_from_a_friend@protonmail.com, Carmen had signed off with, "I wouldn't have found my courage if it weren't for the woman who reminded me I deserved vengeance. Her name is Dr. Vanessa Ellis." I wanted to throw my phone through the window. 3 hours later, Carmen showed up. No appointment. No warning. The buzzer rang. I ignored it the first time. Second time, I buzzed her up out of pure reflex. She walked in wearing all black, fitted dress, leather trench, blood-red lipstick. The look of a woman who had tasted revenge and decided she liked the flavor. She didn't wait for me to speak. "I wanted you to see it," she said. "The fallout. The fire. Everything." I stayed silent. She stepped closer, eyes gleaming. "I did it. Everything you told me. And more." I dug deeper. Used connections. Money. Fuck, I even used one of his own assistants to leak shit from inside the company. She laughed. "I didn't know I had that in me." "You didn't," I said flatly. "You took it from me." She tilted her head. "You mad?" "I'm concerned." "About what?" "About the fucking spotlight you just threw on me." She scoffed. "Oh, please. It's a fake name. A fake degree. No one's gonna trace shit. They don't have to trace it to me. All it takes is one bitter person, one reporter who gets curious, one breadcrumb too many. You gave them a direction. A door." "And," she said, eyes narrowing, "are you afraid?" I didn't answer. Because yes, I fucking was. Not afraid of prison. Not even afraid of exposure. What scared me was losing control. My power came from shadows, from whispers, from staying just out of reach. Carmen shattered that balance. She shoved me into the light, and now I couldn't hide behind it anymore. She stared at me like she knew it. "Don't act like you're above this," she said. "You loved watching me fall apart. I helped you rebuild." "No," she smiled darkly. "You helped me weaponize. There's a difference." We stood there for a long moment, just staring. And for the first time since I started this entire twisted empire, I felt the shift. Not in her. In me. After she left, I poured another drink. Sat down in the velvet throne. Stared out the window. The news had already moved on, some scandal in DC, a celebrity breakup, another school shooting. That's the nature of chaos. It explodes, then fades. But I knew better than to think this was over. Because you don't drop a match in a room full of gasoline and walk away clean. You carry the smoke on your skin. That night, I couldn't sleep. Not because I was afraid. Not because I regretted it. Because I liked it. The destruction. The scale. The ripple effects. I watched the video of Lance walking out of the Sterling Tech building 6 times, each frame a slow-motion car crash. I watched his wife's press statement. The tears. The fury. I listened to his voice on a leaked voicemail. "I can't fix this." She made sure of it. They all did. He sounded broken. And a part of me, the part one usually buried deep under silk and sarcasm, felt something close to arousal. I made that. I didn't just influence it. I orchestrated it. This was no longer about helping women find their voices. This was about amplifying pain. My clients were weapons, and I was their maker. The next morning, I checked my inbox. 17 new inquiries. 17 women who read that article, who saw Carmen's warpath, who heard whispers about a therapist who doesn't give a fuck about ethics or healing, just results. They wanted in. They didn't want peace. They wanted fire. And I knew then, without a shadow of doubt, there was no going back. Not for me. Not for them. Not for anyone who stepped into this room. Chapter 6, The Frankenstein Effect. People think power is something you hold. Like a weapon. A title. A key. But that's a lie. Power is borrowed. Stolen. Sometimes even gifted. But never permanent. And when you build your empire on chaos and broken souls, power is a ticking bomb. Sooner or later, someone always tries to hand it back to you. Wrapped in blood, fire, and teeth. That's what happened the night Maya returned. The last time I saw her, she was crying so hard she could barely breathe. Husband cheating. Baby 3 months old. Sleepless. Hollow-eyed. Her entire body a war zone of fresh motherhood and betrayal. I'd done what I always do. Dismantled the narrative she clung to. Told her to stop breastfeeding a man-child. told her to stop bleeding forgiveness for someone who'd already gutted her. "You're not a mother to your husband," I said back then. "You're not a martyr. You're a fucking woman who's allowed to set fire to the cage they put her in." She'd cried harder. And then she'd smiled. The beginning of a new monster. I hadn't seen her in 6 months. And then suddenly she was at my door. It was nearly midnight. The loft was dark except for a single candle still flickering near the window. I just poured myself a drink, ready to sink into the velvet chair and scroll through my growing list of prospective clients. The buzzer rang. At first, I thought it was Carmen again, but something in my gut turned cold. I answered the intercom. "Static." Then her voice. "It's Maya." My fingers froze on the button. She didn't sound like she used to. Gone was the fragile tremble, the hesitation. This voice was sharper. Dry. Stripped of everything human. I buzzed her in against my better judgment. Some part of me wanted to see what I'd made. The second she stepped off the elevator, I knew something was wrong. She didn't walk in, she stalked. Her eyes didn't look at the room. They hunted it. Hair chopped short. Black hoodie. No makeup. No expression. Like she'd skinned the Maya I remembered and was now wearing her hollow body like armor. She stood in the doorway and said nothing. "Maya," I said, voice calm, masking the low hum of dread building under my ribs. "You're not on the schedule." "I didn't come for therapy," she said flatly. "I came to return something." I said nothing. She reached into her hoodie pocket. For a split second, my mind flashed red. Gun. Knife. Syringe. But what she pulled out was worse. A tiny, worn baby sock. Blue. Faded. I remembered it from her first visit. She used to hold it in her lap like a talisman while she cried. Said it reminded her why she needed to be strong. Now she held it like an accusation. She stepped forward, dropped it on the floor between us. "My son's gone." The words hit like a body slam. "Gone," I echoed, heart pounding. She smiled. "Not dead. Not missing. Just gone. I left him." Silence collapsed over the room like a tombstone. "What do you mean you left him?" "I dropped him off at my mother's place last month. Told her I was going to the store. I never went back." My mouth opened, but no words came out. "I thought about what you said," she continued. "About cages. About freedom. And I realized, the thing chaining me wasn't just my husband. It was him. My son. That's not what I..." She laughed. Cut me off like a blade. "Oh, don't backpedal now. You planted the seed. You just didn't think I'd water it this fucking much." She started walking slowly around the room. Touching things. The candles. The bookshelf. The beige therapy chair like it was a crime scene. "You told me I didn't owe anyone my pain. That I was allowed to escape. Well, I did. Completely." She turned to me, eyes gleaming. "I haven't slept in 3 days. I'm living in motels. Paid in cash. Burned every photo of my kid. I'm freer than I've ever been." My stomach twisted. This wasn't empowerment. This was psychosis. "Maya," I began carefully. "Maybe we should talk. Really talk. Sit down." "Oh, now you want to talk," she hissed. Where was this concerned therapist energy when you were coaching me to cut ties with everyone I loved? "That's not fair," I said, voice tightening. "I helped you find your strength." "No," she said, stepping closer. "You helped me erase myself." The room felt colder suddenly. Smaller, like the walls were bending inward. I'd seen clients spiral before. Carmen had danced on the edge of it. Alina dipped her toes. But Maya? Maya had dived into madness. And now she was circling me. "I came here," she said, "because I wanted you to see what your therapy really looks like. Not the pretty Instagram versions. Not the red lipstick revenge stories." She crouched, picked up the baby sock, and stuffed it back into her pocket. "This is what your work creates. Empty mothers. Unhinged women. Shells. You made a choice," I said, standing. "I didn't tell you to abandon your child. You told me to burn the cage. I didn't say set the baby on fire." Her laugh this time was unhinged. Sharp. She wiped a tear from the corner of her eye, though I couldn't tell if it was from laughter or something deeper unraveling. "Don't worry," she whispered, walking toward the door. "I'm not here to kill you." She paused at the threshold. "But someone will be." After she left, I locked the door. Deadbolt. Chain. And then I sat down. Not in my throne. Not in my power chair. On the floor. I stared at my hands. They were shaking again. I reached for the whiskey, drank it straight from the bottle. The silence after Maya's departure felt like a scream trapped in a jar. My own voice echoed inside me. Every phrase, every manipulation, every drop of toxic empowerment I'd ever sold to a woman begging for peace, but willing to settle for chaos. I had become what I once feared, a cult leader without the Kool-Aid. And now my disciples were revolting. The next day, someone tagged me on Twitter. Dr. Vanessa Ellis gave my friend advice that destroyed her marriage and alienated her from her daughter. She's not a therapist. She's a fucking virus. The tweet had 3,000 likes. That was how it started. By noon, 5 more posts followed. Anyone else notice this woman's degrees don't match up? Who is Dr. Vanessa Ellis? I did a deep dive and found nothing. Is this therapy or emotional terrorism? The internet, my second home, my hunting ground, was turning against me. And for the first time since I built this empire brick by manipulative brick, I felt the weight of its collapse. One angry mother at the door. One ghost from the past with receipts. And now one unstoppable rumor mill. The house of matches I built was catching fire from every side. And I didn't know yet if I wanted to put it out or burn in it. Chapter 7, The Mirror Cracks. I used to think I was untouchable. Invisible. A shadow wearing a stethoscope. A whisper in a candlelit room. I thought I could slide between the cracks of consequence. That I could say what no one else would, pull the pin, and leave before the explosion. But the truth is, you don't get to light that many matches and not eventually burn the fuck down with the rest of it. And now, the smoke is so thick I can't see the door anymore. The fallout started fast. Too fast. The viral tweets were just the spark. Within 48 hours, there were Reddit threads dissecting everything about Dr. Vanessa Ellis. Screenshots of my website. Side-by-side photos of my face with the name Talia Monroe plastered over them like a fucking mugshot. Deep dives. TikToks with dramatic music and phrases like, unlicensed therapist cult leader? They called me a fraud, a manipulator, a narcissist, a sociopath, a danger to women. Some said I should be arrested. Others said I should kill myself. A few called me their hero. But the scariest thing? The women I'd helped stayed silent. No one defended me. Not Carmen. Not Alina. Not even Janelle. They watched the flames rise and didn't say a word. Because they weren't victims. They were disciples. And disciples never protect the temple once they've looted it. I stopped taking clients. Stopped answering emails. The loft, once my sacred space, my empire of illusions, became a tomb. The candles burned out. The windows stayed closed. The velvet chair sat empty. And I sat on the floor. Night after night. Watching the world peel me apart pixel by pixel. Then came the knock. It was around 3 a.m. Soft. Deliberate. Not the cops. Not a neighbor. Not Eli. I hadn't seen him since the day he warned me and walked out of my life with that look in his eyes. A mix of pity and disgust. I thought it might be Meyer again. Come to finish what she started. But it wasn't. When I opened the door, it was a girl. Couldn't have been older than 20. Hoodie. Messy bun. Pale as death. She looked like a ghost. The new kind, the ones born on the internet. Fed by trauma and algorithms. Raised on revenge porn and cancel culture. Her voice trembled when she spoke. Are you Vanessa Ellis? I didn't answer. She pushed past me anyway. Walked straight in like the space belonged to her. She looked around. Took in the silence. The lack of light. The cold air that never seemed to leave anymore. She sat down in the beige chair. And just waited. Like she was daring me to break the silence. So I did. Who are you? Her eyes met mine. My name doesn't matter, she said. But you gave advice to my sister. I waited. She was seeing you under a fake name. You told her to leave her husband. To take the kids. To fake abuse allegations if she had to. I didn't flinch. She did it, the girl whispered. And then last month she drove her car off a fucking bridge. The silence after that was so thick it felt alive. She was 33. A nurse. 2 kids in the back seat. Both dead. Still, I said nothing. Because what the fuck was there to say? I didn't remember her sister. I never remembered them all. They blurred together. Names. Faces. Pain. Stories. I'd stopped keeping track a long time ago. But now one had come home to me. A ghost in the flesh. Her voice broke. I read her texts to you. The screenshots. You didn't just advise her. You egged her on. You told her she'd never be free unless she let go of the guilt. That's not what I meant, I said, for the first time sounding small. But it's what she heard. She stood up, walked to the door, turned to me one last time. I came here to kill you, she said. My breath stopped. She smiled faintly. But you're already dead, aren't you? Then she left. I don't remember how long I sat there after that. maybe an hour, maybe a day, maybe an entire lifetime. At some point, I picked up my phone, opened my files, scrolled through my archive of client notes, my trophies, all those lives I helped rebuild. Each one now felt like a tombstone. I thought of Alina, newly engaged to the man who helped her destroy her ex. I thought of Carmen, the woman who blew up a Fortune 500 executive and vanished into luxury silence. I thought of Maya, wandering motels, childless, soulless, grinning in her hoodie. And then I thought of myself. What was I? A therapist? A prophet? A fraud? A virus? I stood, walked to the mirror across the room, the one I always kept tilted just enough to avoid my own reflection during sessions. I straightened it and looked. What I saw wasn't me. Not Talia Monroe. Not Vanessa Ellis. Just a woman with hollow eyes and trembling hands. A woman who'd built an empire on secrets and shame. A woman who had convinced other women to burn down their lives, then walked away from the flames like a goddamn priestess of the apocalypse. A woman who now stood alone, empty, ashes in her veins. I picked up the velvet chair, dragged it to the window, sat down, opened my laptop, and began to write. Not therapy, not advice, a confession. Every name I remembered, every life I manipulated, every deception, every word I ever spoke that pushed someone over the edge. I didn't sugarcoat it. I didn't rationalize it. I didn't ask for forgiveness. I just wrote. Because if I was going to die, whether by someone else's hand or my own, I wanted the truth to bleed first. They say the truth will set you free. But that's another lie. The truth doesn't set you free. It sets you on fire. I hit publish. Closed the laptop. Watched the sun rise for the first time in weeks. And then I waited. For a knock. A siren. A bullet. A blade. Justice. Maybe nothing. Because sometimes the worst punishment isn't death. It's being known. For who you really are. Not your therapist. Not your healer. Just your reflection. Twisted. Burning. Still smiling.